Welcome to this first panel discussion on redefining work. I'm Mark Mellinger with the Gospel Coalition. I'm part of the Going Deeper with TGC podcast, which I co-host with Colin Hansen. So great to be with you and great to be moderating this panel discussion today. I'll go ahead and quickly introduce everyone who's part of it, and then we'll get right down to it. You all know Tim Keller from Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. Dave Kiersnowski is next to him. He is the CEO of Demdeco, private company. Next to him is Bob Dahl. Bob is chief equity strategist at Nuveen. Catherine Leary Alsdorf is the founder of the Center for Faith and Work at Redeemer Presbyterian. And Greg Forster is a prolific speaker and author when it comes to this area of faith, work, and economics. And Tim, I'll start here. I promised I would go easy on you, and unfortunately, I ended up lying. I'm going to start with you. We won't go that way all day, I promise. I'm interested in hearing a little bit more on what you were, on the area you were talking about when it comes to being the best, Christians being the best at what we do. But it's got to be more than that. It's got to be determining, how do I bring a Christian distinctive to my work? That really connected with me, because I think of somebody like Ted Williams. I'm a huge baseball fan. Ted Williams studied the science of hitting. Probably was the best hitter that the game has ever seen, maybe short of Ty Cobb. He wasn't a Christian. Ty Cobb certainly wasn't a Christian, but he stood out. I mean, anybody would have loved to have gone to Fenway Park and watched Ted Williams play. Mm-hmm. Might have even said he played for the glory of God. So it's got to be more than being the best. How do we work to bring a Christian distinctive to our work?
Well, when you watch somebody, if you watch someone do work that is just breathtakingly good, if you watch an athlete, for example, do something that is beautiful, it does glorify God. It does. In some ways, the way inanimate objects do, the way a sunset does, you realize this is part of an incredible creation, and whoever could have created this. So there's a sense in which being really great at what you do as a Christian, that's one, I don't know, 10%, 15% of how you're glorifying God. You're just good. And you're right that non-Christians who are just good are doing that too. A second way in which just being really good, I know this isn't quite what you asked, but being really good is glorifies God, is it does give you credibility. There's no doubt that, some of you know this, if you have a Christian layperson who is considered so good in their field, so good. Inside that field, the fact that person has faith and is that good, just in some difficult to define ways, softens people up. In other words, if every single Christian a person knows is a jerk, they're not terribly open to hearing about Christianity. They see a movie, they hear a testimony, and they say, oh gosh, every Christian I know is a jerk. But if they even know, even if the person's never opened his mouth, his or her mouth, if they know of somebody who is a professing Christian who is just very admired in the field, it just in some very important ways opens them up. But on the other hand, I would say that it's also true that it's a tremendous witness if people know, for example, that a person is a Christian, and because of high integrity, there's a couple of things they do that keeps them from being as profitable as they could be. Now, if people say, this person could probably be making more money, but they won't do that because they feel like there's an integrity issue there, that actually also can be a witness. But I think also, being a Christian doesn't just mean being more moral than everybody and being better than everybody. It also means, lastly, and that's what we ought to talk about mm-hmm. more, is that in many ways it means I think I do teach differently. I mean, Dr. Lloyd-Jones, for example, one time had a long discussion with his mentor, who was an older physician, who admitted that at least 2/3 of all the people he saw who came to him for medical help weren't really suffering from truly medical problems. Dr. Lloyd-Jones at one point went through his mentor, his overseeing physician, went through his notes, the man's notes, and he saw how many times the guy just said, drinks too much, argues with his wife, can't handle stress, and that the problems really weren't I mean, they were medical only secondarily. And Dr. Lloyd-Jones had a bit of an argument with him saying, we ought to be working with pastors and psychologists. We ought to be working with other people. We ought to be treating the whole person. Because people aren't just bodies, they're souls and bodies. And his mentor was having nothing of that. He says, "That's we're not paid to do that." He says, in fact, we make a lot of money off these people so that then we have the time to work with real medical problems. I mean, he was really very kind of harsh about it. And you could just see that Lloyd-Jones, even though at the time he was, you know, he's still a physician, he was a Christian, that he was coming up with an approach to medicine that was based on the idea that you're a soul and a body. And he was talking to a man who was doing medicine on the basis of the idea that you're just a body. So it's not just that Lloyd-Jones was great at what he did. He was. You know, he was a top-flight person, and he was honest in what he did. But he was actually shaping the way, and he was, of course, he went into the ministry. So I would say all of those things are part of what it means to be a Christian in your work. You know, be excellent. Be moral, but at the same time also be distinct.
Greg, I can tell you want to pick up on this.
I think that story you just told demonstrates that doing your job with excellence and doing your job in a way that sticks out as Christian is not always a different thing. That actually, because Christians have inside information about how the world works from Revelation, and Christians have God working in their heart and all the rest of it, that sometimes we are able to either remind people of what is excellent when they've forgotten, or even push their understanding of what is excellent to a new level. So I think not always a strict separation between those two things.
Yeah. Can I add, I'd say the question is best in whose eyes, in part. Now, the easy answer is how do you best at your employer's eyes.
Hey, Bob, closer.
I'm
to
not
the
on? Am I on?
You're on, closer. Just get closer, closer to your mouth.
Just be closer.
Are we being best in our employer's eyes? And that's important, but if we're best we can be in God's eyes, I think it encompasses 100% of the first part and extends it to a point where then we have a witness. And it's so much easier, in my view, to witness to people by those you come in contact with day in and day out in the workplace than the guy in line at the cash register in the grocery store. That builds your testimony if you are best at what you do, best at your occupation, and your calling, but also best in the way you conduct yourself, your attitudes, your actions, how you treat people, the whole list of things.
I was talking with somebody about this not long ago. We tend to ignore Philippians 2:14. I believe that's the right chapter and verse. Do all things without grumbling and complaining. I work in the secular workforce. To a man, I'd say 99.9% of the people I work with grumble and complain. My guess is it's probably 98.9% who in ministry, in parachurch ministry, grumble and complain. That in itself is a huge Christian witness, right?
Case in point example, I remember well when the firm that I worked for was president of was taken over by another firm. And for the firm taken over, it's always a messy time and lots of people are let go and new culture comes in. And I remember walking down the hall, vividly walking down the hall with a smile on my face, and coming the other direction was a gal who said, Bob, how can you be smiling? They, the new company, are destroying everything we built. What a time for some instruction. I said, Brent, do you have a minute? And then I went on to tell her, this is what's important. Not who's head of this company or where this company's going, but and I went to the harp.
Dave, how do you work this out at Demdaco, a company you run?
Well, I think for us, one of the things that we really work on is the language that we use. And so when we talk about being excellent, and for those who know Demi and I, and we have a rather small company, they know that we are informed by our faith. We try and find language that allows everyone in the company to join in that which I think they want to do anyway. So for example, we look at a concept that Lord John Moulton introduced a while ago called obedience to the unenforceable. And it basically says on one side of a society, you define a society by three sections. On the left side, you have law. Law requires us to do certain things. On the right-hand side, you have freedom. Freedom gives us our choices and things. But the strength of a society is defined by the middle. And that is the section which says, do you pursue that which you ought to do, or are you obedient to that which is unenforceable? And so for us, when we look at being an excellent in our work as Christians, We try and create language within the company that allows the entire company to come into being with that. And we found that if, you know, Lewis used this expression that said you have to get past the watchful eyes of the dragon. So if we create language that allows everybody to come into play with that, we find that their DNA means that they want to do that anyway. So that's how we try and work it out.
Catherine, I want you to jump in here. You can add something to all of this, and I can tell you're anxious to jump in, so go ahead and then we'll get to another talking point.
I just wanted to be the only one that wasn't excellent about everything up here. So I think that the gospel is actually all of that, but it's also that we sin, and that runs through all of us, and if we're going to be risk takers, that means we won't do everything perfectly. So there's some other aspect of living out the gospel that includes repenting, that includes being transparent when you're not all as excellent as you wish you had been. So I think there's that interesting, we can move too far into if we're just excellent, we'll be good. And we've got to sink back into the message of Christ that says we need to be sinners saved by grace.
Absolutely. I think some of the best witnessing I've ever done at work, and I haven't done a whole lot of it, and that's not to my credit, but probably some of the best times that I've been able to witness to the faith have been when I have sinned. I have sinned against somebody. You know, it was usually a snap decision. I made a comment that was hurtful or something, and I've had to go to them and say, I'm sorry, what I did was wrong. Will you forgive me? I don't think in you know, secular workplaces in America, people hear a whole lot of that. Not at the TV station I work for those of you who don't know, I do the evening news in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and you know, the anchorman there is a sinner, no doubt about that. Similar experiences on this panel?
Yeah, one thing, Catherine, you make a really good point, and Tim, you started by saying the story of work is the story of creation, fall, redemption, new creation, and to that point, I think, again, one of the things that we've been fortunate about is we take that model and we use the parallel language of ought is can and will, so business as it ought to be, the reality of the way it is or its brokenness, what we can do about it, how we can make it better or redeem it, and how we hope it will be in the end. And we find that parallel language allows that exact situation to happen, because what we say is this is the picture of our place right now. It's broken. Look all over the company. It's broken. That's okay. That's part of the model that we understand. Make it better. Figure out what you can do about that. Understand it's going to be broken, but go to that chapter 3, we call it. Go to the place where you can redeem it. But again, if we tell them that that's part of the story, to your point exactly, Catherine, then they're going to be okay with that. They're not going to try and hide it. They're going to say, I blew that one, but I can make it better. I can do something about it.
Can I break in? I think, David, that's the second time that you've mentioned coming up with language or using the right words to convey the story that we live in as Christians to our coworkers, to our employees, and so forth, who may not share our faith. I think one of the things that's exciting about making the connection of faith and work is that the workplace is one of the most important places where human beings make culture. And if you look at Genesis 1, naming things is part of making culture. So I think connecting our faith to our work is going to challenge us in all kinds of ways to find the right language to describe the world that will be Christian with integrity, but also understandable to our non-Christian neighbors. Right now, we're that guy at the bus stop saying the Latin name of the common wild duck is, you know, blah, 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 blah. That's what the gospel sounds like to the people in our culture. So I think the workplace is going to be a critical place where we're going to be forced by the reality of the workplace to come up with that language.
Practical example, to your point, I'm in the investment management business. I manage money for clients. And if you're a good money manager, you outperform about 55% of the time. By definition, you're underperforming 45%. So when you walk into a client meeting and you've underperformed, the first thing I say is, I'm sorry. Here's what went wrong. Back to your, will you forgive me? You get a look like, where did this come from? But it's a wonderful way to open up a discussion on all kinds of things relating to what's really important in our lives.
Also, we've spent the first 15 minutes of this panel talking about the workplace. Tim's talk preceding the panel focused on the workplace. But doesn't doesn't work in the Bible include more than just employment? In other words, work doesn't just equal job. It has just as much to do with calling and vocation. Greg?
Well, I think that's exactly right. As I've been saying for a long time, work is not just in the workplace. It's in homes. It's in neighborhoods. It's most of your life when you start adding it up, and particularly most of your waking life. And I think even, I want to go along with you and say we have to talk about stay-at-home moms. I mean, I love stay-at-home moms so much. I married one. We have to talk about the work that gets done in the neighborhood and so forth. But even people in their jobs need to think of their work independently of the paycheck. Not that the paycheck's not important. I mean, it is. But we don't want to teach people, boy, your work is important to God, so go do your work and glorify God and do it with excellence and so on. And we send them out into the workplace, and the reality for them is, I pull this lever and I get a paycheck. And that's the extent of my world, right? We don't want to leave people. We want them asking, what does this lever do? Right? What impact does this lever have on the world? Maybe it makes widgets that go in cars or whatever it is. But we want people to think about their work as something that images God, manages and develops the creation order, glorifies God, serves their neighbor, and all the rest of it. And thankfully, it also creates economic value, and that's why you can get paid for it. But you don't want to be focused there.
Catherine, I think this is an area where we all struggle, viewing work primarily as a means of getting paid as opposed to contributing.
Yeah, I've been fortunate to have jobs where I got a lot of meaning out of the work that I did. And I think that is a connection point for lots of people is, what does it mean, and how can I feel like I'm contributing meaningfully in the work that I'm doing? And that's a big role of leadership to be able to provide and guide towards some of that meaning. I think the other thing you're raising here, though, is work beyond the whatever hours you're doing at your paid profession. So to some degree, and I think pastors understand this more than most of us, to some degree, your work is everything that isn't Sabbath or leisure. Mm-hmm. Specifically designated in those two directions, because you're working to keep your home clean, or you're working to keep your car maintained, or all those things. And so to have a theology of work means, I think, to look at every kind of work, whether it's paid or not, under the same biblical theological lens.
Well, because otherwise this discussion does not pertain to people who stay home with their kids. This discussion does not pertain to people who are retired from the paid workforce. I mean, as a Christian, you never really retire. You never step out of the game, right?
It also causes a great lack of integration in your life. So if you're very compartmentalized to your paid hours versus the work you do in your non-paid hours, you struggle with that word integration or holistic.
Tim, you're the theologian on this panel. Let's talk about this a little bit. Do people have trouble seeing this, seeing work as more than just my job? Or do people who don't have jobs have trouble seeing the value of whatever it is they do?
Yes.
Why?
Ah.
You never ask a yes or no question without asking why.
That's right. Come on, open-ended. What I liked about, let me put on my theologian's hat.
Yeah.
What I liked about Calvin and Luther, how they complement each other, is that Calvin and Calvinism tends to talk about how work shapes culture. It's sort of creative. You're taking, just like God took raw material and rearranged it in order to bring about human flourishing. That's really what creation is. He took the earth was without form and void, and he takes this raw material and he creates it, he rearranges it, so now it brings about human flourishing. Music is taking the raw material of sound, turning it into something that brings beauty and meaning and so forth. Luther tended to talk not so much about work as, creation or shaping creation, but as caring for creation. It's more like, less like creation and more like providence. That what you're doing is you're watering and nurturing the world, and you're taking care of people, and you're feeding people, and you're keeping them secure. What's helpful about Luther is there are lots and lots of jobs, especially, that are like taking care of children and cleaning your house, that are extraordinarily important because they are, we think of it as just maintenance. It's not very creative. Well, it's caring for creation. It's enormous. It's like, it's so. Now, you're not going to feel like work is a calling unless God is asking you to do it. Work is just a job unless somebody asks you to do it. I mean, vocation means someone called you to do it, so it's got to be God. Christians have the raw material for calling. They can say, either my job is God's way of, he's calling me to take care of other people, helping other people. I'm loving, I'm letting God love people through me. And the Lutheran approach helps you see even so-called menial chores as God's calling. That's why he was the famous one of saying, the farm girl who's milking the cow, that's a calling from God. But at the same time, I do like the Calvin side, the Calvinist side, which says, but work can also be a way of really reshaping this world and really, really turning it more into the kind of world that God wants it to be. And both of those are exciting callings from God. And I think you need both of them, or else certain jobs get left out. Like you said, people who are in retirement or who are staying at home and caring for children very often feel like, well, I'm not doing God's calling. So you need both of those to give people a sense of calling.
Well, and they're both in Genesis, where it says Adam was put in the garden to work it and keep it.
That's right.
Right? That those words imply both of those, both the developmental growth imperative,
yes,
and also the preservational imperative.
Yes.
In your question, you talked about us being made in the image of God, and we didn't touch on it in the answer here. So I would just add that, of course, God, we all know, is a worker in creation and sustenance and redemption, et cetera. And as a result, as being made in his image, we are workers, whether we get a paycheck or not.
Yeah, and I would add, being made in God's image, also remember God is three persons in one being, and work is made for community. We work with other people. To work is to be engaged in not only serving others, but interacting with others. We give and receive through our work. And through the economy, we become co-workers with millions of people because our work interacts with their work and so forth. Now, in the Trinity, why do the three persons work together and work together so much that they have only one will? It's because they love each other and they have a common being. They have a common root. Now, human beings are not God, obviously, but there's an imaging of the Trinity in the way we work, that humanity has an organic wholeness that we live out through our work, because work is relational, and yet every individual still matters and has intrinsic dignity, and the distinctiveness of the person is just as important for us as it is in the Trinity.
Yet isn't that what drains most of us when it comes to work? It's the fact that we have to work with other people.
Depends on the people.
I guess it does. For so many people, that's the dream job, is to own your own company where you don't have to work directly with somebody face to face, shoulder to shoulder necessarily.
I don't know
every
about
day.
That. When you own your own company, do you have to work with other people?
At times.
At times.
Not to put
but
you
I
on
wanna,
the spot.
I want to publicly state that I love everyone in my company. So, you know, just not an issue.
Especially if they paid their bills on time, huh?
Help us with this, though. I mean, Catherine, you've dealt with this for so long. In fact, you know, you've been the CEO of a couple of major private companies dealing with software and technology. It is, I've heard, my dad was in management, I never have been, but I've heard just about anybody who's been a business executive say, the hardest part of my job, the thing I spend the most time working on, is not the area of passion, the stuff that I really got into this business to get my hands on. The hardest part of my job, by far, and the most time is consumed by dealing with people.
So you know you're in a really black hole when you're leading a company and you are angry at your customers, your investors, and your employees. You know you're in really bad shape. And I think the heart of that is you've started to say, I'm working for me instead of working for all those people that you no longer like in that moment. And that's really the switch, whether it's paid work or not paid work. It's in fact all those people that I am supposed to be working for. And just because they didn't like get in line exactly like I might have dreamed doesn't mean my work for them is stopping. It means that I just have to approach it in a different way.
Yeah.
So it's a symptom of a very deep misalignment of calling when we're having that response.
Well, it goes back to the idea that Tim got at in his talk, which is that we get our self-fulfillment from our work, and work is all about me. I don't see it as contributing to caring for God's created order. Work is all about me. So when I'm focused on myself and what I
right.
want, and I go in with the expectation that I should always be getting what I want, other people are going to hack me off, and I'm going to feel sinful in my heart. I may respond sinfully even outwardly. Pastor Tim, help me with
no,
that.
No, I'm going to say a little levity, and it's a little maybe cruel levity. I have a professor friend of David's too, who said that the inside joke around his university is professors say students are the barnacles on the ship of scholarship. And he says, education would be great if you could just eliminate the students. And you know, Greg, that's why intellectuals go into think tanks. It's education without, forgive me. But anyway,
we'll talk afterwards.
I think you've already, well, it's the reason why pastors go into full-time evangelistic ministry. The Tim Keller Evangelistic Association, no parishioners,
yeah.
You know, I preach the same thing everywhere I go. And I think that you really nailed it in saying, Catherine basically nailed it, when I said you're working for yourself. It's not a calling anymore. If you really say, I would be a great educator if I didn't have students, what you mean is I've got these brilliant ideas that I've got to get out into print, and the students are just a kind of means to an end. And honestly, I thought the calling of, you know, the calling of a lawyer is to do justice. The calling of a educator is to change lives, is to bring students up. And it's very, very easy. It does become about you. It does. And if you just can't handle people, you've lost a sense. That's a very important aspect of what it means to see your work as a calling rather than just a job.
And I think one of the reasons that happens with people in the church is not only because we're all very selfish at heart, but also because we have not, as leaders of the church, cast a vision that their work could mean more than just working for themselves. And in fact, sometimes as a church, we reward them working for themselves because we like their giving or
That's
we
right.
like their leadership skills. So to cast that vision, to going back to the biblical narrative, to cast that vision of redemption, I think opens up the opportunity for people to see themselves doing something far greater and far more important than just building up a certain lifestyle.
This is something you're saying all pastors should be doing, casting that vision.
Absolutely. I don't know where else it would come from.
Amen to that. And I think part of what this plays into is how we see other people and how we interpret the actions of other people. If you as a pastor want to teach people to love your neighbor, then you have to teach them to have this kind of response that we're describing when other people are difficult. One of the things that I love about my Lutheran friends, the Lutheran Catechism has a statement that we, as part of the duty to love your neighbor, you have a duty to interpret the actions of others in the most charitable possible
mm-hmm.
light. Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's hard. And that's part of what makes loving your neighbor so difficult. But if your customers or your coworkers or your boss or your employee or whoever it is being difficult, it might well be because you're not doing your job with excellence.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might well be that mm-hmm. they have a need that has not come to your attention that you are responsible to become aware of and begin to deal with, or something else of that nature. It's so difficult in our you know, born nature to interpret it that way.
This is where the fruits of the Spirit come in. I mean, all the things we're talking about are satisfied if we are able to execute on the fruits of the Spirit. Patience is one that comes to mind in the conversation we're having now. If we exhibit patience and show love through that patience for that difficult situation, what a wonderful moment of redemption and gospel.
And how do, what sorts of disciplines do the rest of you on the panel build into your lives to help you with this? Because honestly, I mean, you can help me in this. I'm sure you can help our friends in the audience and those who are listening online, whether they're pastors or not. I know pastors have to deal with people all the time. But just about everybody does. And I don't think people, I can know this stuff intellectually. I can know it intellectually all day. I can pray about it, and I can pray earnestly, and people still frustrate me. I still hate them in my heart, and I don't like it.
Other than biting our tongues a lot?
Right, other than, but there you go. That's part of it. What, sir, what disciplines do we build into our lives to make this, lessen this? Yeah,
Dave? I feel like this is going to be a response that would be similar to someone in a debate for a political response, which is I'm going to completely ignore what you just asked and go back to Catherine's comment earlier,
fine.
But I'll tie the two together.
You can do it.
No, so the question is what disciplines? I think for us, we would look at it again with what way do we as a company, and we have a very tilled conversation within the company. We have someone in our company whose title is the director of cultural conversation. So we take this.
What
this,
does that pay?
I've never heard of that. It's, can I get that job?
We can work it out, Tim. If you want to move to Kansas City, we can work it out. So the point is, I think there's a way to try and work within your company to see the reality of the nature of your company, and by seeing it clearly, you don't check out of the game. So the question about people frustrating you. I think it was Bob Dylan who wrote a song, Everything is Broken. And one of our conversations internally is, I don't often use this language, although with some of my friends I do, this side of the new heavens of the new earth, what we say is the reality of our current situation is it's messed up. It's just all messed up. And we know that. And so when someone says something to you that might tweak you in a wrong way or might disappoint you, it's kind of like when the stock market already has priced something because they knew the information. If we work within our companies knowing that information, that it's broken and we can do something to make it better, but it's not going to be perfect in the near future, then I think that that gives a sense of grace to all of us when we listen to people, when we work with people. Because it doesn't make us check out of the game. We're not so frustrated by their response or by our particular response because we understand, there it is again. Chapter 2, it's broken.
Yeah, it helps me too, even though I still struggle with it, to pray for that person or those people. I don't see the sin go away. I don't see the ugliness in my heart go away, but I do see it start to shrivel a little bit. Other ways that some of you can,
I don't want to overly spiritualize an answer, although this is a theology conference, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. This is the moment where, are we going to be a Christian or not? Are we going to be salt and light as God has asked us to be? And, you know, what that means in each situation is very difficult. But if we're building and having built in our lives Christ, don't our responses begin to move in a direction that we can have, I'll go back to the fruit of the Spirit again, to be able to meet the need, to turn the head and say, wow, that's not a response I expected. I thought you were going to hit me back, as it were. And again, a teachable moment can ensue.
How do we begin to discern which work should take priority in our lives? I mean, let's get back toward integrating all of life, and not just talking about, you know, the 9 to 5 hours, you're punching a clock or going to the office. We all have work, depending on our marital situation, our closeness to extended family, the season of life we're in, the church we're in, and the needs that it has. How do we begin to discern which work should take priority? Bob?
Calling, I think, it's the starting point. Obviously, the first and general calling of following Christ in salvation and lordship, but our secondary calling, unique to each one of us. What does that look like? How is that formed? The experiences we have, the talents and the abilities that God's given us, the counsel we receive, the answers we get when we look into His Word and pray. I think that all informs our prioritization of work very generally.
And I think part of what the church is going to have to do as it gets on top of this faith and work integration is become a place that teaches people to discern calling, that helps people cultivate a wisdom and an internal compass. You know, the traditional answer to this question that was developed by the theologians of the Reformation is three things: that you look at the needs around you, because that defines your calling. That's one way God calls you, is by creating needs. You look at what you're equipped and able to do, and that's not just a matter of your skills or your resources, but it also includes things like your personality traits. And then thirdly, what do you feel called to do? And I actually, my tendency is to emphasize the needs around you, and I have actually been called out by some people, including by your book, Tim, on the importance of that internal sense of calling, because you emphasize this. And that was very helpful to me, because if we don't include your sense of being called as part of how we get called, then it becomes very controlling and external, and it's not rightly motivated. It becomes even a Christian liberty issue if we give you your gift assessment, and then we tell you, well, based on your gift assessment, you have to go here.
One of the things that we do at DemDeco to try and help people understand, in essence, the use of their time, work, is that we try and paint, and again, we try and use language that all can come around. So we try and paint, though, a Jeremiah 29 picture. And we talk about common good within our company. In fact, all of our conference rooms, we have about 11 conference rooms, are all named after someone in history who sought the common good. So it's a Mother Teresa, and it's the Booth family, and it's Wilberforce, and you know, many of our heroes in different fields who sought the common good. And so for us, part of it is just the definition of what we're about. We have a kind of a tagline with our company that basically says we seek to lift the spirit. And that gives them a picture that can transcend to the way in which they do business, the products that we make, the way in which we treat each other, et cetera. And they view all of that, in essence, as not necessarily work, but their response to what we do. So for us, it's trying to make sure that the picture is a fabric versus one thread, and we try and get them to have an idea of a way of being, a response to all of this, rather than a particular task.
Catherine?
Yeah, I think we could teach every Sunday of the year on calling in our church and still have an oversubscribed class. So if you're trying to think of how to get into more of this topic, just announce that you're doing a class on calling, and I think you'll have plenty of material. So I spent a lot of time talking to young people about that, and I even spent a lot of time myself trying to sort out what my calling is going forward. And so of high interest to all of us. All that preface, I lost what I was going to say.
Oh yeah, well that's okay.
I wasn't called to say
it. It happens to all of us. You weren't called to speak on. Well, you were. No,
subject.
I called on you. I'm sorry.
An external calling, but not an internal calling.
maybe that's what it is. At a Calvinistic
It'll
conference,
come back.
We can get away with that.
I'm going to jump in as soon as it comes back.
Yeah. Okay. That's no problem. Tim, I mean, you work with young urban professionals all the time who are trying to discern calling. We have just a few minutes left in this conference, so don't take too long, but a couple of good nuggets that would help for people who haven't read your book.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah.
Well, Greg pointed out, it's in the book. I've got certain things I always say to everybody. I'm not even sure I want to go there. I'm watching our clock. I've been asking myself the question, okay, our topic is we're redefining work. Mm-hmm. I think we are redefining work as calling. I mean, that's basically
right.
It is calling. Calling is doing something because God's called us to do it. I actually think if when I put on my Calvinist side hat, calling is the way I discern my calling is I look inside and say, what am I really good at? I want to find my talents because I want to be able to make a contribution. If I'm artistically talented, I want to do that. If I'm better at managing people, I want to do that. The Lutheran hat kind of says, don't look inside, look out there and see just what people need, just what needs to be done. and do it and do it well. And I think both of those are important. I think we because I think the traditions are complementary, you've got to keep both those together. And very often, either way, I mean, if you respond to needs outside, you eventually find what you're good at. I mean, if you say, I really want to help there, and you find out you're really not good, you end up getting to what you're good at. The same thing the other way. If you start by looking more at what you're good at, obviously at first you say, I really want to do that, but there's no opportunity, and you end up getting, you might say, God disciplines you through what's actually happening in the world and brings you to the place where you're doing what really needs to be done, because I say, I've always wanted to do that. Well, nobody's asking you to. There's no opportunities for it. There doesn't seem to be a need. So you can start with the need and you get to your ability. You can start with the ability, you'll get to the need. Those are ways of finding your calling.
Can I throw in mine now? Thank you.
You can.
I also, so many young people, and I think I was in that mix, really didn't have an idea what they were good at. One piece of advice that's sort of practical is to go apprentice to someone who has found their calling. Mm. So even if it's not your area, to be able to serve under and work for someone who's got a deep sense of calling, I think can help a person get from that right out of school to where God wants them to be.
What about those who, maybe I'm going to use the sense of calling a little bit differently. But what if somebody is good at something, there is a need for it, but they don't like doing it? Is it
no passion, you mean?
What's that?
No passion or inner desire.
No passion. No. Mm-hmm. Is that still their calling, or should he or she legitimately be looking for another calling? Because I know several people like that. They're competent at many things, but they don't want to do what they're doing.
Well, I think it's a matter of balancing the three things: your abilities, people's needs, and your sense of calling. So if somebody is about to fall off a cliff and you are the only person able to grab them in time, but you don't really feel passionate about doing that, you should still
You're still called to do
that. Yeah, exactly. So again, this is why there's no simple answer. Instead, we have to have churches become places that train people in wisdom, because there will be times when you have to do things that you're not passionate about. And yet, over the long term, as you build a life for yourself with God and in cooperation with God, it will not be sustainable in the long term to drag yourself to the office day or wherever it is, day after day after day after day, if you don't feel called to that. That sense of feeling called is part of the means that God uses, and we need to respect that and just be wise about balancing the three categories.
A couple minutes left. Bob, you look like you wanted to say something about this.
I firmly agree. It's the three. How do they come together? I have nothing to add.
That's all he wanted to say. Tim, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Greg's right. Right now, I feel like the passion thing is overdone. There's no doubt you're not going to you shouldn't do something you really hate doing, or you won't be able to sustain it. But I also, I wrote a book on marriage in which I tried to say, there is no doubt that young people seem to have the same sense, that feeling like, unless I'm passionately, attracted, there's this incredible charge, I have to find the person who I have this incredible chemistry with and we keep it the rest of our lives. You do not know anything about marriage.
Right, that's just never going to happen. Sorry.
Get a grip. And it's like, I do feel that same naivete is brought into work, that you would just want to be utterly passionate about it. I actually think it's hope. I try to say that at the very end of the talk. Mm-hmm. It's our hope that there is a tree, that there is justice, that the things that we're looking for God is going to accomplish in the world, and that's what keeps you going more than anything else. Why other people who don't have that hope just tend to give up and just stop being patient. I think in the long run, you need hope even more than, because passion comes and goes. It's true that you need to find something you enjoy doing. If you hate it, but so.
And, go ahead, Greg.
I think you can find enjoyment as well if you open your heart to seeing what does God do through my work. You can find things that you then become passionate about.
A good note on which to end this panel discussion. Thank you, panelists. Appreciate it. Looking forward to some more discussions. Thank you.